Hello, everyone. My name is Jean Strauss. I'm the director of the Coleman Center for Scholars and Writers here at the New York Public Library. Welcome. We're delighted to have you here, and thank you for braving the elements on this truly freezing night. We're very happy to have you here. And I want to thank Science and the Arts at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York and Adrienne Klein, who co-sponsored this evening's program with us, and many of you may well be here because of that email. Also, warm thanks to the staff of the Coleman Center, Marie Dorigny and Katie Pyatt, for helping make everything go so well tonight. You will have found on your seats a card like this, which has an illustration by Lauren Redness on the front, and on the back has announcements of the spring lineup of the conversations from the Coleman Center. I forgot to say at the beginning, this is the opening night of the conversations from the Coleman Center in the spring season, even though it doesn't have anything to do with spring outside. We have truly a terrific lineup of programs, which you can see. Some of the writers on offer for the next few months are David Besmozgus, Francine Prose, Karen Russell, Colm Toybean, and Wells Tower. We'll have the historians Annette Gordon-Reed, Maya Jazanoff, Jill Lepore, and Carla Peterson, and the journalist and author George Packer. If you'd like to get notices about our programs by email, please sign up on the sheet by the door as you leave. And if you do that, please, we'd love to know how you heard about tonight's program, whether it was through us or through the Graduate Center or some other way. In case you're not yet a friend of the New York Public Library, we also have these folders on the door that way to the left of the door, which explains how to join. Of course, we'd love you to become a friend of the New York Public Library. So please do that at whatever level you like. And now, finally, it is a tremendous pleasure to introduce tonight's speakers. We are all in for an extraordinary evening. Lauren Redness is a brilliantly gifted artist and writer. Her writing and drawing appears in a number of publications, including the New York Times, which nominated her work for a Pulitzer Prize. She published her first book, I meant to have it in my hands, but I don't, Century Girl, 100 Years in the Life of Doris Eaton Travis, Last Living Star of the Ziegfeld Follies. She published that book in 2006. In 2008, 2009, she was a fellow at the Coleman Center here upstairs, where she worked on a project that we'll hear about tonight. It's a visual and written narrative called Radioactive, Marie and Pierre Curie, A Tale of Love and Fallout, which was just published by HarperCollins in December. Here's a copy if you didn't see it when you were coming in. The book and its author have been getting appropriately fabulous reviews, and NPR can't seem to get enough of Lauren. She's been on All Things Considered, Leonard Lopate, and Science Friday. In addition to the exhilarating pleasures you'll find between the covers of this volume, the cover itself glows in the dark. You have to hold it under a light source for a few minutes and then go into a dark closet and you'll see. Many people find this out when they've been reading it before bed and then they turn out the light. A mutual friend of Lauren's and mine, David Ferriero, this whole exhibition upstairs, which I'm going to talk about in a second, was David's idea. He got a copy of the book. He was reading it late at night, turned over at 4 o'clock in the morning and sat glowing at him, and emailed Lauren, I think at 4 o'clock in the morning, and said, do you know about this? And she said, I don't know what you're talking about. Actually, Lauren was going to make cupcakes, radioactive cupcakes for tonight, but there are too many of you who said you were going to come to the event, so no cupcakes. During her year at the Coleman Center, Lauren worked extensively with materials in the library's collections, the research collections, and upstairs on the third floor galleries now, we have a dramatic exhibition showing her finished works alongside the items in the collections from which she literally and figuratively drew inspiration. Alas, the galleries aren't open now, but please come back during library hours to see the exhibition, Saturdays, Sundays, and Mondays through Fridays. The hours are posted on the internet and they're outside. It's quite an extraordinary thing to see, and I hope you will all make sure to do it. Lauren teaches at Parsons, the New School for Design, which is co-sponsoring this exhibition. We're extraordinarily grateful to Parsons, and especially Sven Travis, the dean of the Parsons, for helping us out with this. A class of students Lauren was teaching last fall worked together on the highly imaginative website that accompanies the exhibition. You can find it on the New York Public Library website if you click on the exhibition spot, or on Lauren's own website, laurenredness.com. Dr. Harold Varmus won the 1989 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for his discovery with J. Michael Bishop of the cellular origin of retroviral oncogenes. Before he decided on a career in medicine, he did not do the oncogene discovery before he did. Before deciding on a career in science, he earned a graduate degree in literature at Harvard. I cannot possibly do justice to his astonishing career in this short time, but a couple of other highlights. He was director of the National Institutes of Health in Washington from 1993 to 1999, then president of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center from 2000 to 2010. He was appointed a co-chair of President Obama's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, and in July of 2010, he went back to Washington to become director of the National Cancer Institute. So he currently divides his time between Washington and New York. Somehow, in the midst of all that, he found time to give three lectures for us here at the New York Public Library, lectures that he expanded and transformed into this excellent book, The Art and Politics of Science, published by Norton in 2009. And with his son Jacob, a trumpet player, he has performed a series of concerts called Genes and Jazz at the Guggenheim and the Smithsonian. Both he, Harold, and Lauren are singularly qualified to have the conversation you're about to hear on art and science. I won't take up another second of your time except to say that you can purchase books by both authors after the program, if you haven't already, and also posters for the radioactive exhibition, and both authors have kindly agreed to sign books. They'll be at that table, I guess. Is there a separate table? They might have to be at that table. Okay, they'll be on the left. The books, you can buy them on the right, and you can get them signed on the left. So thank you, and Harold, Lauren.
Okay, thank you very much. Jean, thanks for that very nice set of words. I want to thank the audience for coming out on this difficult night, and I assume you've done so because you've heard about or seen in light or dark or read this really wonderful book that Lauren's put together. And in the course of the next 45 minutes or so, Lauren and I are going to chat about the book, what it means, what science and life have to do with each other, how science is done, how people work together in laboratories, what radiation's all about. We're going to touch on a lot of things, but at the end of that 45 minutes or so, we're going to open the floor for questions, so I hope you'll think about what we have to say in relation to your own curiosity about the book. To get us started, I'd like to talk about 100 years ago. This year is 2011. 100 years ago was 1911. This year has been declared the International Year of Chemistry to celebrate the Nobel Prize, her second, given to Marie Curie, reward her for the isolation of polonium and radium. In 5 days before she was set to receive the Nobel Prize, she wrote the words that are at the front of Lauren's book: "There is no connection between my scientific work and the facts of private life." So that's the book's epigram. Is it true? Lauren offers apologies to Marie Curie. Why? More importantly, perhaps, that is a moment in Marie Curie's history which has incredible tension. I thought it might be useful for Lauren just to get us situated in Marie Curie's life by talking a little bit about what was going on in those difficult days of early December in 1911 that inspired her to write those words, which were sent in response to anxiety on the part of the Nobel Committee about whether or not she should appear to receive her prize.
Right, so as you say, it's 1911, and Marie has just been awarded this unprecedented second Nobel Prize, and right at that moment, a love affair that she's been having with the physicist Paul Langevin is exposed. Paul's wife has found their love letters and given them to the press, and the Nobel Committee becomes very nervous. And
we might want to say that, right, although Paul has a wife, she doesn't have a husband at that point.
Right, so Pierre Curie has passed away 4 years earlier, which maybe we'll get to at some point, the details of that. But exactly, so and Paulus actually was a former student of Pierre Curie's, and their children were educated together, and they have this very passionate affair that is documented, unfortunately, in letters that are given to the newspaper. And so the Nobel Committee does not want to be tainted, does not want their ceremony tainted, does not in particular want to worry about seating at the royal banquet. Where will King Gustav sit? Will he be comfortable next to some sordid woman like this? And so Marie protests, and she says, no, actually, as you say, there's no connection between private life and the facts of my scientific work. And the reason that I preface the book with an apology to Marie Curie is because, while on one hand I want to respect absolutely the truth of the matter there, which is that, you know, rumors about a love affair have no bearing on whether or not she has isolated the elements radium and polonium, of course. On the other hand, the characteristics that you know, her passion, her curiosity, her intellectual adventurousness, I think these qualities are actually very central to her as a scientist and as a human being in every aspect of her life. And these are implicit and explicit connections between science and love that I make throughout the book.
So one of the interesting things about Marie Curie, and there are many interesting things, is that she was engaged in some pretty heady partnerships. She did her initial work with the man who became her husband. But when she did that work, what was her first relationship with Pierre?
Right. Well, even if we could perhaps even step back one relationship, because when she was still in Poland, in order to raise money for her education, she had ambitions to go to Paris to get an education that she wasn't able to get in Poland because of the Russian occupation. And she falls in love with the eldest son of the family of whom she is the governess. And this is something that just happened actually this week. I was contacted by the grandniece of this man, and he told me that in fact, they declared their love and that they were going to get married, and his parents said absolutely not. And eventually they broke off the romance, or at least the prospects of marriage. But Marie and this man who is a math student named Casimiras, they continued the relationship for 5 years. This woman told me this week that there are actually letters between them on into the time that she was living in France, and he was helping her with mathematical equations. So even in her earliest youthful romance, she had this intellectual partnership. And then the most famous intellectual partnership of her life is, of course, when she falls in love with Pierre Curie, and they work together.
Well, she falls in love, but right, after what happened, they were together in the lab because she was a graduate student at the Sorbonne, and he was a professor, actually a student of the third person in their first Nobel Prize.
Oh, Henri Becquerel. Of
right.
Course, yeah.
So Becquerel made the fundamental discovery in some ways, and then they picked right. up interesting parts of it. In fact, it's quite amusing to look back on that and to see that Pierre Curie was actually working on something a little different, and as Marie, who was so focused on the radioactivity part of it, and seemed to have seduced her mentor. To work on this problem of radioactivity.
Yeah.
And then, you know, contrary to what happens in today's world of Nobel Prizes, she was awarded her PhD in July and was announced she would win the Nobel Prize a few months later. That doesn't
Not
happen
bad.
Too often these days. and went as a graduate student of her mentor, who then was her husband, So it was pretty tight. You mentioned descendants of—I didn't know about this descendant of the fellow with whom she had had that affair in Poland. I'm not sure affair is the right word. Youthful romance. But it is interesting in the Curie story, as probably many people here know, the descendants of the Curies, of course, had a pretty big impact on science, and the descendants of Langevin.
Right.
Tell folks about that. It makes you feel like the world's an incredibly small place with only a few people doing science. But
so very early on, I think after Marie lost Pierre as her collaborator and then she lost Langevin, she began working with her daughter when she was just 16 years old during World War I, setting up mobile X-ray units. And her daughter did go on to become a very accomplished
physicist. A lot of us bring our kids to the lab every now and then, but they very rarely go on to win Nobel Prizes with their spouse.
Right. So Irène Curie worked in Marie's lab, and she fell in love with Marie's lab assistant, who was Frédéric Joliot. And in 1935, just 5 months after Marie died, they won a Nobel Prize in the discovery of artificial radioactivity.
Right. Artificial radioactivity means what?
They were bombarding aluminum with alpha particles. They actually had the most intense source of alpha particle radiation because of Marie, because of her work. So they had an advantage working in that lab.
I mean, it is useful to make that distinction. The kind of thing that Pierre and Marie were working on was, these are elements that have an inherent ability to give rise to radiation. You don't have to heat up anything. Just the compound is there and produces particles. Whereas then you could also induce radioactivity by bombarding another element with the first radioactive element. We often say, as both Lauren and I have said, that she isolated these materials of polonium and radium. But it is daunting to realize what she was doing 100 years ago, starting with a something that people threw away, something called pitchblende that has uranium in it and other isotopes. And she figured out something quite amazing about pitchblende, that there was a source of radiation in pitchblende that must be much more potent than the uranium. The uranium was there in small amounts, but there must be something else that was there in even much smaller amounts. And the separation process 100 years ago, before some of the more modern technologies for isolation became available, is really a tour de force. And it makes you think about how mysterious radiation must have seemed to people, and still does to a certain extent. Now we are all, I find myself amazed every day by the wireless in my own apartment, that all these, if I had the right BlackBerry, I could get any signal for anybody coursing through my room. And I raise this issue because, there was a lot of interest in the discovery of radioactivity, as your book mentions, and of course many other people have commented on this. And as soon as it became obvious that there was some sort of magical property, fantastic spiritual property to these elements, they were immediately tried as cancer therapies, and a lot of effort was made to exploit whatever properties they might have. It also led to some thinking about spiritualism, and it created the problem of how do you define the boundaries between something as mysterious as radiation or radioactivity and something which may not be scientifically sound. Right. Tell us about the Curies, and they had a relation. They were drawn to spiritualism.
Absolutely. As you mentioned with your BlackBerry, I mean, this was also a period where lots of new wireless technologies were coming into daily life. Electricity, the radio, the telegraph, the X-ray was new, and now radioactivity. And as you say, because these technologies had such a magical gave such a magical impression that that allowed people to have curiosity and a more open-minded perhaps approach to something like spiritualism. You think about an invisible light has passed through the human body and exposes the skeleton. That seems so fantastical. Why should we not possibly consider that you might be able to contact the dead or levitate, or who knows? So the Curies were among many intellectuals of the period, and not the only Nobel Prize winners, who attended seances. And in particular, there was one Italian spiritualist medium whose seances they attended. Her name was Giuseppe Palladino. And I've seen Pierre's lab notebooks where he documents his times at the seance, and he's, you know, very particular, just like he would be with any other lab experiment. He's, you know, he's controlling the environment. He's, you know, looking under the table, and also he weighs the medium. Apparently, he weighs Giuseppe Palladino before and after. And in his notebook, he says that she gains 6 kilos. So I don't know. It's like they turn off lights and she's eating cookies or something. I don't know what's happening. But
probably it's heart failure. It's too many fluids.
But the thing that I think is really interesting about that, and actually, I created a font for this book and I named it after Giuseppe, because the fact that they went to seances, I think, may seem like hokey to us now or funny, but I think that their curiosity and their openness, that they were willing to take this leap of imagination into the unknown, into what we can't see, that's something that I think allowed them to be great scientists. I don't know what your thoughts would be.
Well, a little disappointing to me that they didn't figure out what the trick was.
Right.
but you can't expect everything. I want to ask you a couple of things about the craft of the book. One is a question about a stylistic question. I'll come back to that in a moment, but you've already touched on the font. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about how these images became so luminous and so haunting. I think one component of that is the connection that exists in the minds of many readers between the figures you've drawn and either classical figures or images from Renaissance painting, sometimes images that we have from modern dress or not modern but early 20th century dress and manners. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you found all those images, many of which are displayed in the exhibition upstairs that I urge all of you to go have a look at, because it's really quite wonderful. And maybe tell us a little bit about that and about how you developed the cyanotype drum. We can use the images if you'd like.
Okay,
we do have these modern appliances here, our own wireless, our own radioactivity.
I'm just going to skip ahead to be able to answer your question. As you mentioned, and as Jean mentioned, this is evident in the show, I was working here at the library while I was doing research on the book and creating the artwork, and so I was looking at all of these incredible materials that are in the library's collections, and these are examples of what are called cigarette cards, and they're actually really, really tiny. They were given away in series in cigarette packages. This is from a series called The Age of Power and Wonder, and the connection is obviously more direct. And then these are from another series called Famous Love Scenes. And so these two themes of scientific advance and also romance. This is a photograph of Ted Shawn and Ruth St. Denis. And I just love like the melodrama of the theatrical splendor there. And then this would be an image from the book where you are seeing the lab and the lovers.
And the lab images come from pictures of the Curie's lab?
That's a drawing I actually did in the Institut Curie in Paris. There's they've preserved Marie's lab, and that's a what's called a piezoelectrometer, which Pierre invented and which Marie used to gauge the ionization of the air. Okay. This is from the library's picture collection, and it's obviously a depiction of a Greek vase. And what I loved about this was the two-dimensional stylization and the repetition of the legs. And when I made this image, which comes right before Pierre's death, I condensed that into one horse to give an impression of motion. And this is an example of the cyanotypes, which you can talk about more in a sec. But, another example from the library. This is the latest effects in lace mitts and silk gloves and one automobile glove. And I wasn't interested in lace necessarily, but just in the expressiveness of a single hand. These next couple images you'll see what they lead up to, but this is a Goya etching from late 1800s. And the frontispiece to a book of Milton's poems. This is a book jacket from the library's book jacket collection.
Luminosity in early time.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and then we, like, so these gather together to this. So anyway, there's more, but if we could get into
that was Pierre, by the way, being carried away.
Right. So, these...
But tell us about this cyanotype, I know comes from your going through pictures of plants from...
Right. Yeah. So, is this what you're referring
to,
about Anna Atkins? Exactly. So, in 1843, a woman named Anna Atkins, a botanist in the UK, was working with this technique that had just recently been discovered about a year earlier, and using light-sensitive chemicals applied to paper, and then placing, in her case, algae on the paper and exposing it to sunlight. And so she's creating like a photogram. And I like that idea of using a process based on exposure for thematic reasons. You know, we've been talking about radioactivity and x-rays, and also for aesthetic reasons, because I thought that this white line, the inverted image, gives that impression of internal glow, and Marie Curie described radium as having a spontaneous luminosity. I thought that was appropriate for the subject matter. And I can just...
Sure. Do you want to show you made a little video about this, which I found quite touching. Did you
know
that one?
Oh, yeah, I have that. Yeah. We can cut right to that. There are a couple steps. Should we do a couple steps before that?
Sure, it's up to you.
So this would be like a final image, and then these are some of the sketches that go into making that final image. A still life. These are musicians that drew downtown. This is a faculty meeting at Parsons. I'm not the only one at Parsons who's drawing in faculty meetings. Like, the whole faculty is drawing. Dummies created by the L.A. Darling Company and then dressed by JCPenney at the Nevada test site that were used in the doom towns that were built at the Nevada test site during the Cold War for atomic bomb tests. You'll see these legs show up in a second in the final image. This is a Spanish painting I saw at the Guggenheim. These are other images from the library's collections. These are a playing card that's actually really tiny, and that's an etching, and that top figure on the fountain gets redrawn a bunch of times and ends up here in that depiction of that 1911 royal banquet. You can see all those different component parts get Xeroxed and recombined to become one composition. And then that's turned into a negative. So where Anna Atkins was using the actual algae and placing that on the paper, the chemically coated paper, to expose it, I'm making a negative. So this is somewhere between like a photographic negative and a photogram. It's just an acetate of the drawing. And then once the paper is exposed to sunlight, it turns blue. Then I rework it in colored pencil and add the text. But should we watch a video?
Well, I think gotten the idea, but we can come back to watch the video later. Your mention of the test site, that reminds me of one thing I wanted to ask you about the style. The first time I read the book, I was struck by the fact that many dramatic scenes are interrupted by a jump to something about modern life. So, for example, when Paul Langevin, the lover, is responding to a journalist who was accusing him of these extramarital affairs, and they have a duel, they're about to they're firing at each other, and suddenly you stop the scene, and there's about five pages about Nevada test site and things that are happening. And there are many other examples of interruptions like that. When I went back and read the book again, I realized that there was a method to this madness, that in a sense, the duel and the test site were manifestations of bloodless conflict.
Right.
Because in that duel, nobody gets hurt. In the Cold War, you could argue there is some hurt, but there's no actual hot war. There are other examples in which For example, Madame Langevin is holding on to secrets, and then you have that's interrupted by something about people who were trying to figure out nuclear secrets. There's an example when Marie has given up her affair with Langevin, and she goes to stay with an old friend, and then there's an interruption to talk about bomb shelters, and this is all about shelters, going to some place for comfort.
Right.
And I have four or five other examples, which I'm not going to bore you or the audience with, but I wonder, how did you plan that out in some way that it was intended to make these themes obvious to the reader? It took me a couple of readings to begin to perceive that each of these interruptions in the flow of the narrative touch on some theme that has to do with fallout,
right,
with some aspect of the world that was changed, not necessarily for the better, by radioactivity.
Right. Well, I'd like to think that the reason that you didn't pick up on them the first time is because they're subtle, not because they make no sense. But yeah.
Well, I was trying to reinforce that idea, right? By saying at least in the second time I got it.
Yeah. So, but exactly. I mean, what my hope was that each individual anecdote or moment or research of a particular scientist is interesting in its own right and worthy of attention in its own right, but then it also acts as a reinforcement of the narrative in that place.
I mean, the one thing that made me feel that there was a whole other dimension that wasn't necessarily getting explored was that most of these interruptions are to introduce some unfortunate aspect of the discovery of radioactivity. Yeah, we lived in fear of the Cold War. We were setting off bombs. There's an interruption that deals with Hiroshima, and that there are benefits of radioactivity. Obviously, you make a pretty good case that we would all acknowledge it. And understanding more about the elements and how they behave as physical entities, of course, is a good thing. But there are applications of radioactivity that are, of course, incredibly important. Everyone knows about the use of radioactivity, especially radium, in some cancer therapies and the use of positron emission, another kind of radioactivity discovered later in medical imaging. But what people sometimes don't know is the importance of radioactivity in medical research has led to a lot of discoveries. And I thought I might just illustrate for a moment for the audience some of the things that I see as the virtuous outcomes, the beneficial outcomes of what Marie and Pierre initiated by describing these elements that have the ability to give rise to energetic emissions that are very useful in research. So, Laura and I have talked a little bit about this before, and I thought I'd just, for a moment, since the issue has come up, say a couple of things about how radioactivity had an influence in the lives of many scientists of my vintage. And, you know, as recently as 40 years ago, almost all of us were tracing molecules or cells by putting those biological entities into little vials that had a fluor in them, something that would be activated by an emission from a radioactive compound like tritium or carbon-14. Indeed, in New York City in the 1940s, a professor at Columbia named David Rittenberg for the first time tagged red blood cells with radioactive substances and was able to show that a red blood cell lasts for about 120 days in the circulation. That was, of course, a major discovery with respect to understanding anemias. For many of us, radioactivity was the message that first delivered good news about experiments. I don't know if you can get the first of the images that we put together here. When I was a trainee at the NIH 40 years ago or so, we used to stand in front of a scintillation counter like that and put samples in one by one, and by watching the ticking off of radioactive emissions, I was able to see for the first time. I had a tool for measuring the amount of particular genetic RNA in a bacterial cell, something that would have really been impossible without radioactive detection. Now, we've moved away from this laborious sample-by-sample use of radioactive probes. So now, if you want to determine the sequence of DNA, something you've all heard about, at least for many years of DNA sequencing, the kinds of images shown on the left were developed by using radioactivity, usually the isotope P32, to show up a ladder of bands, very, very pleasing aesthetically, not quite as pretty perhaps as some of your drawings, but nevertheless, to scientists doing this kind of work, it allowed you to read off the sequence, ACTG and so forth, of genes and begin to understand the nature of human chromosomes. Now we're all making a shift away from radioactivity. Radioactivity is actually not even used in many of our labs, and we're resorting to another kind of detection device, fluorescence, which is what you have on the copy of the book. That's not radioactive, it's fluorescent. Make that distinction. Fluorescence is not dangerous, it's photons, just light. Radioactivity, of course, is at a high dose, unlike these doses, can be dangerous. So we are all happy to be rid of radioactivity in our labs, free of radiation permits and radiation inspectors and all the things that go along with having radioactivity as part of our lives. But radioactivity played a huge role for a while, and whether we're looking at DNA sequence or gene expression, the images being produced by fluorescence have the advantage of being safer, being more colorful, allowing multiple probes at once, and I think you have one more picture. Those probes can be used, for example, to detect with different antibodies and different fluorescent probes multiple different proteins or different substances in the cell. So you're seeing a cell with a nucleus that's stained with one fluor and then proteins that make up the skeleton of the cell, if you will, that are detected by other probes. And you can actually formulate fluorescent probes that are as numerous as several hundred and look at a single sample or a single cell for many different characteristics all at once. So obviously radioactivity played a role in developing this improved, safer, more beautiful, more functional technology, but that aspect of the story is sometimes neglected when we think about them. In some ways, has been the most burdensome aspect of radioactivity in our society.
Yeah.
There is another aspect of radioactivity that I wanted to talk about a little bit, and that is the excitement that was occasioned when Marie Curie came to the U.S. You know, she came on a couple of trips. The first time she came to New York, 1921. By that time, she was inadequately supported. Many scientists today, you know, are complaining about government support, but that time she just didn't have enough money to buy radium, and folks in the U.S. had gathered together some money to buy her some additional radium. She came to the U.S., and the fascination with her history and with radioactivity produced a sensation. When she came to New York, she was, and then went down to the White House and met with, at that time, President Harding. What was the big moment there for you in reading about all that?
Well, I think that, you know, it was an interesting moment because it was, as you say, 1921, her first visit, and the women in America had just gotten the vote the year before. So I think, and it's part of, you know, Marie Curie, I think, would be a great figure no matter what the timing of her life. But, of course, I guess you can never separate someone from their time. But in particular, I think, because she was a woman who had won two Nobel Prizes, she was so celebrated when she came here. The headline in the New York Times was, you know, Marie Curie cures all cancers, in big letters. And
there was, of course, a follow-up just a few days later.
Just kidding.
No. Well, more or less. I mean, the follow-up was she then said some cancers, maybe. And of course, we know that radiotherapy with radium is not prescribed very frequently these days. But
Well, it's...
But there's still a cures in the paper every day, so it's just different in nature.
But I have to tell you one story. When I told my mom that we were going to do an event together, you know, I was like, Mom, I'm going to do an event with Harold Varmus. And she said, that sounds like a great match, honey. And I said, yeah, he, you know, discovered the cancer gene and won the Nobel Prize. I drew a few pictures of Marie Curie. It's like, only a mother can think that's like a good match.
Your book is selling better than mine, though.
On a serious note, though, I guess my hope for the book is exactly that it opens up the opportunity for other voices, and I think that is the point of those digressions or juxtapositions or however you want to put it. It's like, I'm not a scientist, I'm not an expert in these fields, but I can talk to people who are experts and who do, you know, who have done incredible work. And, you know, because I'm not so focused on the particular work at hand, I can make the connections between those things and make, hopefully, poetic connections that can reach a lay person, but still give voice to, you know, this important work that's happening.
I think we're going to put a hold on it right there and open the floor for questions.
Were you proud of this work, or were those serendipitous? Yeah, totally
serendipitous. Yeah. Although there is, green fluorescence is probably the most commonly used form of fluorescence, and you may have had some feeling about using green as... Indeed. Well, that's the principle is really embodied here. That is, antibodies are used to being tagged with green fluorescence. And you're right that you're obviously up to date on some modern surgical methodology which is allowing surgeons not just to look with their eye to see if they've removed things or to wait for the pathologist to come back and say this section is clean, but instead to tag cancer cells and look in a field. In a room that's been darkened, just as you might deal with this book, which has got a fluorescent attribute, you can look in the surgical field and see whether there are residual cells that need to be removed.
We have two microphones, one on
either
side. So if you have a question, just raise your hand, and then we'll get you a microphone.
Yeah, when I was a child, I used to go into a shoe store. I don't know if it was Florsheim or Tom McCann or which one, and I would put my foot in some device on the floor, and I would see my skeleton.
Yeah.
What was that?
that was radiation, and that's a practice that is not practiced by Harry's, I'm happy to say. So when I go into Harry's shoe store, I just try out the shoes. It's dangerous. But it raises, you know, a more general issue, and that is how much radiation of various kinds, not just the radioactivity we're talking about here, but other kinds of radiation one can be exposed to. We all go and get chest x-rays. That's photons. That's not radioactivity. We all go out in the sun. We get UV irradiated. All of those exposures have an effect that is mediated by something else we haven't actually talked about and probably should talk about, so thanks for the question, and that is that the damage that radiation of that kind does to us is largely a result of the ability of these high-energy photons or radioactive particles to cause damage to our chromosomes, mutations. There are mutations occurring in our cells whether we're bombarded by radioactivity or not, because the process of cell division is not perfect. Indeed, if it were perfect, you and I wouldn't be here, because the origins of life would not have led to the variation and evolutionary process that produced different species and different individuals. So there's an inherent error proneness in the way life is established, and that proneness can be exaggerated by exposure to to physical forces that have the ability to damage DNA. Damage to DNA underlies cancer. Cancer is the major risk from radiation. We all get exposed to some low dose in our lives. That dose is by itself unable to produce a detectable increase in our cancer incidence. Lauren and I were discussing earlier this debate that still goes on about whether below some allegedly safe level there is no risk or some very slight risk that's hard to measure. Is there a threshold above which risk occurs? We have mechanisms in our cells for repairing damage that's done to our DNA by radiation. And hopefully your repair processes were actively at work following your exposure to the shoe store. But many people have had that kind of exposure. Whether it actually has caused a significant increase in cancers is very hard to say. But there are dangers all around us.
Lauren, here, the other direction.
Oh, hi.
I actually stood up. I'm actually curious, what inspired you to do this project? You as an artist, a very physics-heavy work, and also how much physics you learned at the end of your work. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
I like it.
Thank you. Well, my work has for a long time involved drawing and oral history. And for a long time, I was working, doing pieces for the New York Times on the op-ed page that combine drawing and interviews. And I think because I felt constrained by the format of working for a daily paper, but also the fact that they were in black and white, I then was drawn to do more or less the opposite in my first book, which was to do a very visually rich and, you know, glossy papered spectacle of a book about, at least on the surface, the theater and show business. And so I think, you know, after having spent a couple years on that project, I wanted to, again, go in a very different direction. And so from, you know, spectacle, I turned to interior lives and invisibility. And the combined themes of love and radioactivity intrigued me as a visual artist. How could I look at that, you know, the idea of invisibility?
This is a question for Ms. Redness. You mentioned that you did some sketches in the Curie's lab in France, and of course you also mentioned that you did research here in this building. I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about other travels that you made and other researches that you did in various locations as preparation for the book.
Sure. Right, as Harold mentioned, I spent a good deal of time in Nevada at the Nevada test site. I traveled to Hiroshima, talked to atomic bomb survivors. I went to Three Mile Island and talked to people who had been there during the partial nuclear meltdown of the plant there. Where else? A lot of time in France. I traveled to Warsaw, to Marie's house, her birthplace, and I can't remember, a few other places. Pardon?
What did you find in Poland?
There's actually very little in Poland. I think because Warsaw was so destroyed in the war, and actually this relative of Marie's first love, who I spoke with this week, told me that apparently there had been an extensive correspondence between this man, Kazimierz, and Marie, and that was destroyed during the bombing
in
the war.
Are there memorabilia? Yeah. Are there tributes to her? Because, you know, France, of course, is rich with them. And,
right.
You know, we think of, if you ask the average person, name two scientists, who do they say? Yeah. Einstein and Madame Curie.
Right.
But it's interesting. She, of course, as you point out in the book, that wonderful page that has all the allusions to everything that's Polish. Since I have Polish ancestry too, I was glad to see that Poland was getting was figuring so largely in the book. But she obviously named polonium, for example, for Poland, and was a very loyal Pole in many ways. And yet, not much remains in Poland, as far as I know.
Right, but it's true that the country is obviously very proud of her, and there are statues, and her home has been turned into a museum, and there are photographs.
So the original home does remain.
Yes. Yeah.
What is it like? How'd you feel going there?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, it's very small and modest, and which seems fitting with Marie's character, and if not her persona, and there are a lot of family photographs. The one thing that I really loved in that museum was a tiny diorama recreating the what they call the hangar, where she and Pierre did most of their work. And the Sorbonne wouldn't give them a laboratory; they gave them this, you know, old wooden shed that had been used for human dissection. And there's a recreation of that, which I found very touching. But I think that street has probably been rebuilt. It's old Warsaw was burned down, so it's not the actual physical structure that she was born in.
You mentioned something about her character, and to some observers, she seemed cold and withdrawn and analytic, and yet what the history of the biography reveals is someone who obviously was turbulent inside and very sensitive. So, you know, as you began to learn more about her, did you feel you were enriching the literature on what her character was like, or did... What was your own response to these various aspects of her personality that have been recorded by others?
Right. I think she was a very private person, and I think that makes sense of the discrepancy somewhat. I think that she was very passionate, and that's what we learn in all of her private papers and her diaries that are at the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris. And then she even writes, you know, when she writes letters to her family or friends, she's disturbed by the fame that she receives, and I think that causes her to withdraw. And I think, and also having endured the scandal in 1911 with Paul Langevin and the criticism, that also caused her to withdraw. So I think her public persona became much, more guarded.
I encountered a description of her two daughters, especially when they came to New York together. One of them was immediately perceived as being a scientist, and much more contained. She was the one who went on to get a Nobel Prize in physics, and the other daughter, much more interested in fashion and became quite a literary sensation, wrote the phenomenal biography of Marie Curie that was published a long time ago. Were you surprised? Did you learn more about the two daughters? It was quite striking to see how different they were.
Right, and actually, it turns out that Eve Curie, the younger daughter that you're talking about, the one who is more interested in fashion, she was apparently in a reading group with a number of the women who are involved with the library. I don't know if Susan maybe was going to come in, so that was fascinating to talk to those women and hear about her. And apparently, you know, because she was the only person in her immediate family not to get a Nobel Prize, they said when she turned, I hope I'm not, this isn't too personal, I don't think, but apparently when she turned 100.
There were five Curies, right? Five descendants.
Right. So when Eve turned 100, this reading group gave her a Nobel Prize for friendship, which I thought was so sweet.
It could have been peace, right? There's some other questions out there. Uh-oh, my wife has the microphone.
Exposed. You mentioned Pierre looking with interest at the lesions on his hands or arms. I was wondering what the two of them did to protect themselves. Did they have any sense of how dangerous what they were working with was?
I think they did, and yet they did not protect themselves. I think when Pierre, as you described that incident where he put a vial of radium against his arm and he found a lesion that didn't heal for, 52 days, I think it was.
He seemed to be ecstatic about it.
Right, it was a discovery.
Look how powerful this thing is, and what it can do.
Yeah.
But they did learn with time to carry the radium in lead containers, and they were able to, of course, monitor the signal. I think that the notion that Marie Curie was careless and just spilling radioactivity all over herself is exaggerated. That all the evidence I've read suggests that she was actually quite a careful worker. You have to be careful, of course, to isolate something, one part in a million, and get it out of pitch blend.
Yeah.
But there's very little doubt, something we haven't talked about, that her death is almost certainly attributable to whatever exposure she had, because if you work with that much radioisotope over a long period of time, you're going to have damage. And she died of aplastic anemia that was almost certainly radiation-induced.
Right. But I think in a way the question speaks to what you were saying earlier, which is that they saw this power and they saw its beneficial capacities, even as, you know, it was destroying his tissue, but they understood that to be potentially beneficial.
Destroying tissue mostly means destroying cancers.
Exactly.
And actually others leapt to that too, but that was, you know, evidence that there was tissue-destroying properties in this substance. And has very long half-life, and it can go a long way. So,
having the two of you up there together, I can't resist asking the following question of you. That is,
Dan knows us both very well,
right,
too.
So. Harold, you wrote this wonderful book on the art and politics of science. And you wrote The Art and Politics of Science, this wonderful memoir. And Laura, of course, you wrote and drew Radioactivity. So I wonder whether the two of you would converse just a little bit about the art of science and the art of art, and try to compare them a little bit, or contrast them, whichever seems appropriate, or maybe both.
I don't know where to begin with the art of art.
Yeah. But I think there's an aesthetic to science that's often unappreciated that is not just rooted in the visual images, a few of which I illustrated for you, but is embedded in the way in which experiments are designed. So I would argue that the isolation of radium, for example, from pitchblende, was an amazing and beautiful piece it's not just science, it's a product of the human intellect of saying, okay, I know there's something important in this junk pitch blend that I normally would throw in the waste paper basket. And I have a way to measure what I'm interested in. And now I'm going to take this material and I'm going to fractionate it in various ways. I'm going to break it up chemically and put it through various separation devices. And I'm going to use this tool I have for seeing how things go. And then when you write that up in an artful scientific paper, you're expressing something that's gone on at a very high level of intellect and understanding of the world that is emotionally very satisfying. That's why I want to get away from just saying she isolated radium, because the process of doing that brings aesthetic pleasure, something that's it seems improbable, and then you achieve it.
Is also, at least for me, some kind of a search to arrive at something that feels like truth, even though it may not be a unique factual truth. There's some kind of imaginative truth that hopefully you are
seems just difficult, that you start with a problem that whether it's a problem of transforming a canvas into something beautiful, or whether it's taking some mystery of nature and trying to understand it. It's a product of the intellect overcoming the difficulties of achieving something that other human beings can appreciate. So I think there are parallels. Sometimes we struggle to make them work, but I think that in my own thinking about science, it seems to me increasingly important with time as we begin to think about justifying what we do in terms of only pragmatic outcomes, to recognize that there is something uplifting about discovery. One of the reasons I like astronomy, this week my wife and I were down at the Smithsonian looking at this wonderful collection of images taken by various NASA probes in the deeper realms of our solar system, there is no real pragmatic benefit to lots of that stuff. Seeing the moons of Saturn moving across the face with the shadows of these icy spheres shown on the surface of Saturn, or seeing Mercury moving as a tiny dot across a fiery surface of the sun, you know, there's no utility to that. There's no way the economy is going to improve as a result of taking those pictures. But it does give us a new perspective on what it means to be an innocent mote in this universe, and I think that deserves its own rewards. At that point, science is helping us the way art does by giving us a perspective and a heightened view of what human possibility is all about.
Wonder.
To what extent is she to be either credited with or blamed for the development of things like nuclear energy and ultimately nuclear weapons? And what were her political beliefs?
Marie Curie was a pacifist, and she didn't feel that she should, or both she and Pierre didn't feel that they should patent their discoveries. And Pierre Curie, right away, I think, in 1905, in that Nobel speech, he asks the question. He says, is it right to probe so deeply into nature's secrets? The question must be asked whether the results will be harmful or will be beneficial to mankind. So they were struggling with this ambivalence of, you know, of course, they're part of a whole series of discoveries and that increase the understanding of the atom that many, many scientists are a part of. So you can't kind of draw one line from their work, but do you want to speak to this?
Well, they would have been very at home in the current debates that we're having over patenting of genes or sharing of genetically engineered mice or sharing of information or publishing our work in open access journals so everybody could read them. And it's clear that the Curies were very much on the side of openness, a creation of a scientific community that was at ease with itself and in a way that sometimes is not the case. So I'm full of admiration for them. And the other point to make here is that discoveries that are made by science frequently have the potential for harm or the potential for good. And that's true of virtually everything we've mentioned, whether it's in virology or genetics or radioactivity. And one reason I wanted to emphasize the beneficial aspects of radioactivity is that there are ways in which I could say that much of what we now know about medicine, many of the things we do in medicine would not have happened if the Curies had not opened up this notion that not just radium and polonium and uranium, but lots of substances are radioactive, have emissions that we can use for beneficial purposes. Uranium, obviously, and once we knew about artificial radioactivity, which was, of course, a step in development of bombs, and that's a property of matter, which had both good and bad effects on the way we've lived in the 20th century. I'm getting a signal for termination from the boss. If there's one more question, I would take it, or Laura, would take it. Let's take one more, just to defy authority. the microphone's coming to you. Okay. Maybe we'll take two more, since you have.
Is this microphone? Yeah. No.
And that's a friend of mine down there too, so he has a chance to do it.
I just wanted to actually follow up on the question about truth and beauty. To Dr. Varmus, is scientific discovery, the experience of discovery always beautiful in the sense that, I mean, are there things like you in particular working on a cancer, coming to understand how cancer is working, even if it's the most horrible kind of cancer you can imagine, is there something incredibly beautiful about the workings of nature and coming to understand them no matter how terrible it is also?
Yeah, we're not going to press the beauty button too heavily. I think that happens sometimes. But what does happen is you ask a question, you get an answer. It can be incredibly satisfying, especially if you've done it in a way that's clever and convincing. And I think you're right that I don't think anybody does cancer research without some notion of the toll that cancer takes on human populations. But most of us can't shoulder that burden every day in the lab. We have to be thinking about what we're trying to do. And of course, a lot of the work that goes on in the field of cancer research does not go on while you're standing in the room of somebody who's dying of cancer. You're doing the work with experimental models, with cells and molecules, and I think it might be extremely difficult to be wrestling with the question at the same time that you're worrying about you're doing it under the pressure of trying to minimize or diminish suffering that's going on right next door. It's a driver, it's an abstract driver, sometimes a specific one, but it's not one that I think you can get satisfaction from the activity, even though you know that the problem you're working on has unfortunate consequences. But you know, we're not trying to create cancers; we're trying to cure them and understand them. So I think there's a basic pleasure that comes from trying to unravel a problem that inflicts suffering on so many. Let's take Bob's question then. Two more beyond that. So we're violating your authority even more than I wanted to do. All right.
Is this on? I guess is it. This is a question for Lauren Redness. Your book is in a way a follow up on the questions about science and art. Your book is called Radioactive, a Tale of Love and Fallout. And I wonder if you could bring that part of the story in. And I wonder, too, about the fact that both of your books are about these incredibly playful and imaginative and powerhouse women. And I wonder if there's a continuity that you could say a word about.
I guess in reverse order, it's funny. I mean, of course, I've noticed that about these two books, that they're both about very strong and dynamic women. It was not a conscious, I didn't seek to do that. It's sort of in retrospect that I see both books have that common thread. And in terms of the title, Love and Fallout, I think it gets at exactly the duality that we've been talking about, the possibilities for beneficial, you know, cancer treatments or space exploration, you know, all of the different possibilities that a scientific...
You're not going to say nuclear power, are you?
I didn't. that the possibility that a scientific discovery can open up, and then, you know, that there is this other side. If that gets any additional information.
There seems to be a parallel between the life of Marie and Chopin. They both left Poland and came to Paris, and I know he never went back. I don't know how often she did, but what was her feeling about music and about Chopin?
I don't know specifically what her feeling about Chopin. And I can't really speak to her feelings about music. I know she really loved poetry. She wrote poetry. She memorized poetry in Russian and in Polish, and you find those writings in her archives, in her journals. I'm not sure about the music.
Well, I want to thank Lauren for joining me tonight, and thank all of you for coming, too.
Thank you.